Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to call Senate State Affairs Committee to order. Today is Thursday, January 27, 2022. Let the record reflect. Time is 3:32 p.m. Today we have President, Vice Chair, Senator Reinbold, Senator Costello, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Hall, myself, Chair Schauer. Please turn off your cell phones. Good news, pretty small audience today. We have Naresh again with us as the committee aide, Carrie with Senate Records, Alex with the LIO. Only two items on the agenda today. We're going to get into hearing bills now, moving on, that we've got stuff available and ready. First one's going to be Mr. Josh Appleby, Chief Staff, Lieutenant Governor's Office, introducing for the administration, Senate Bill 167, request of the governor relating to elections and much more. Mr. Appleby, you know the drill. Coming up, sir, put yourself on the record. As a note here, we also have Mr. Thomas Flynn, who will be online as a lifeline to ask questions for all of us as well as we go through this. And when you are ready, Josh, take it away. And I will remind you, thanks for that. If you are brief and talking, you're welcome to take your mask off. We're going to go with the Senate floor policy. If you're not, please just leave it on for the trying to respect what we so far have as the rules in the building to the best of our ability, even though especially on the third floor, you don't do that. All right, Josh, you have the floor. Go.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon. To all members of the State Affairs Committee, I think the last time I presented a bill was via telephone. So I think it's going to be the first time in my position that I've come to a committee and actually presented a bill. So thank you for that opportunity.
I see you face to face.
Mr. Chairman, you began the conversation about election reform well over 3 years ago. And you continue to have those discussions here in the committee. You have those discussions with other members of the legislature. Senate Bill 167, as has been said, is not here to overhaul an existing election system, but rather to tighten it, strengthen it, make it better. The governor and lieutenant governor are offering this bill to add the ideas to the broader discussion of election integrity and reform that you continue to have every day. As the lieutenant governor has said on many occasions, this bill brings together ideas from a lot of bills that have already been introduced and are under discussion both here in this body and in the House. And he hopes that it will shine a spotlight on the issue of election reform. As stated in the governor's transmittal letter, this bill will improve voter rolls, secure absentee and in-person voting, and increase the identification and investigation of election crimes. By ensuring election integrity, this bill will give all Alaskans additional confidence in the election process, including the election outcomes. This bill will improve the voter rolls by requiring the permanent fund dividend applications request the voter registration in order to be added to the rolls. So an opt-in type system. It'll update the voter list maintenance practice, audit the voter lists every other year, and issue reports to the legislature. And as I've said before, you'll hear these ideas, they sound familiar because they are already in discussion in other bills, both in the Senate and the House. This bill will provide more secure absentee voting practices by requiring signature matching, notice of defect, and cure for absentee ballots, prohibiting the division from sending unrequested absentee ballots to anyone, outlawing ballot harvesting, allowing voters to request absentee ballots in four-year increments, and require the provision of prepaid envelopes for all absentee ballots, so voters won't need postage to return their ballots. The bill will secure in-person voting by prohibiting voters from providing alternate forms of identification and preventing those providing assistance at the polls from influencing voters and their votes. The bill will further define unlawful interference with elections, election fraud, and election official misconduct. It creates a toll-free number to report these and other election crimes and require that public safety officers receive training in detecting and investigating election crimes. This bill will further ensure election integrity by allowing additional hand counts, prohibiting private funding for elections, requiring the centralized destruction of election materials, and instituting routine forensic examination and strict chain of custody protocols for the voting machines. Now, does this bill include everything? No, it doesn't. Are there elements included that come from both sides of the debate? Absolutely. Both the governor and lieutenant governor's office look forward to your feedback, your input, and your support as we work to move election integrity forward this session. Certainly, it's a discussion that we continue to move forward with your office as well. Thank you again for scheduling this hearing for the bill, and I'm happy to proceed with the sectional analysis if that's your preference, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Josh. I just want to add for the record, we do have Director Fernamiai from the Division of Elections also has called in. So those were the two we were expecting from the Department of Law and DOE to be available. I've said plenty in the last couple of years of elections, so I don't have anything to add as we get into it, but I will open the floor if anybody has an opening statement before we get into the sectional analysis. Senator Costello.
Thank you. I appreciate that you made the comment that the bill before us includes provisions that are in many bills that are in the legislature right now, introduced by both Republicans and Democrats. And I think as time has gone on and I've heard this bill and other issues and Senator Schauer, your bill, I mean, I'm becoming convinced that election integrity benefits everybody. And there are some things that just make so much sense to me, like being able to track that your ballot has been received by the division. I mean, if I order shampoo from some company, I can see when it left to when it arrives at my door. Why aren't we doing something like this with something as significant and important as a person's ballot? I think that's wonderful. So I don't want to take too much time. I did have one question. I was under the assumption that Gail Fanoumiai had said in her presentation that with ranked choice voting, it's not really possible to do a hand count. And she doesn't have to answer that now, but whenever it's a good time, Mr. Chair, she could respond to that because Mr. Appleby had mentioned that that's in this bill.
Josh, if you want to take a first tack at it, then we'll go to Director Fanoumiai just to answer the question. I'd rather us answer questions. That's why we're here. So this is the initial hearing on the bill, and this does come out of the previous committee hearing where there were some questions, so might as well get them out.
The provision in the bill dealing with additional hand counts deals with a form of risk-limiting audits. Right now, the division can recount and hand count one random precinct per district. This bill makes it permissive that if they see something that's not quite right, maybe received a significantly high number of complaints, they can expand that from one to more than one to see if there's something actually going on.
Thank you.
And I will add to that just from a language perspective. I was talking to somebody earlier today on some election legislation. It was said that there isn't really something such as a forensic audit for elections because it's really, if you want to use the correct terminology, that's about money. You know, when you're doing a forensic audit, so it's really more like a risk-limiting audit is probably the proper word for it. I say it all the time, too. I'm guilty of that, saying forensic audit. You just think, oh, we're going to dive into the forensics of it, into the bowels of the system and what's tracked. So it's probably good for all of us to think about, it's actually the right word is risk-limiting audit for elections as we tie the appropriate language to it. So I'm going to have to adjust my own speaking to that as well. And then, Director, if you have anything to add, please feel free if you put yourself on the record. If you don't, that's fine. But in response to Senator Costello's question.
Through the chair, this is Gail Fanoumiai from the division. Josh stated that provision is related to the hand count verification process already required in statute.
Okay. And just related to the just to make sure, Senator Costello, the question was answered. You were asking about related to the question in a previous hearing about hand counts with ranked choice voting. Do you want to clarify the question, or are you satisfied with what you have so far?
Mr. Chair, it appears that I think Ms. Fanoumiai's comment earlier had to do with an entire hand recount is not possible, and now what I'm hearing is we already are allowed to have the division do that with one precinct. Now what this bill does is it expands that if they sense that something is going on, that they can make that choice to expand it to more than one precinct.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
And Director, maybe just as a clarification point, this is back to just the language we use, so we're speaking apples to apples. I think there is that misconception, and if you could help us clear it up, that would be good, on when you say hand count versus like the algorithm and the complexity factor of running all of those in one location once you get everything back for tabulation. The comments have been made or have been said, heard around, whatever you want to say, that is something that you can't do. Even the lieutenant governor, I believe, has kind of said that. Well, you have to have the machines to do the tabulation. Too complicated. A person can't do that when you get into a second round, a third round. So that we're all speaking the same language and we don't get it wrong. Can you clarify from the question Senator Costello had what I'm kind of talking about, that kind of broad understanding or maybe misunderstanding of a ranked choice voting setup and then the ability to or not to hand count those results?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. As I stated before the committee, I believe it was on Tuesday, it is not possible in a timely manner to be able to conduct a hand recount of an election that utilizes ranked choice voting. The division has historically, as required by statute, for I think the last 15 years or more, to do a hand count of one randomly drawn precinct that would show that the precinct scanners are counting the ballots accurately. And that process will continue even though ranked choice voting will be taking place in the general, because they will recount, that state review board will do that hand count verification still of the first choice on all ballots.
Senator Costello, are you okay with?
I'm done.
Okay, good. All right, that's good enough for now, Director. Thank you. I just wanted to make sure we didn't skip that. And I think at this point, not seeing any other hands up. Josh, if you want to continue with the sectional analysis, and we'll do the talk about the financial note at the end of that, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to remember, 38 sections in this bill. As someone who has built large bills, you know.
I do.
So I will try to go through these, you know, not too fast, but not necessarily dwelling on them either. And I provided the sectional analysis that everyone has access to as well.
Slow down. If somebody has a question, we'll slow down. Taking it, and otherwise, just keep doing your thing until we get a hand up.
Great. Section one, along with really we're talking about sections 2 through 5, 31 and 32, all deal with the permanent fund and the change in the voter registration process for that. Section 2 directs the division to register those who submit a PFD application, and they have to request. So it's, again, this gets back to the opt-in. You have to, you know, you'll have some sort of pop-up, and you have to say, yes, I want this information to change my voter registration. Section 3 requires the applications include a way for applicants to do that. And again, it seems like a lot of little things, but as you remember working through this, even to get to this point, there were so many different sections of statute that get touched. And so you want to make sure that they were all consistent, they all achieved the same results. Sir.
Thanks. Just a question on this new section.
Which one?
Just section 3. I do have questions just generally for the ABR issue, but the person, let me get this straight. So the person will have to get the personal positively or affirmatively request to be registered. Then Department of Revenue under section 3, under section 3, they have to permanently or affirmatively request. And then can you explain the second, just that last sentence about the proof of identification, if the department or if DOR doesn't already have possession of a person's identification?
Now, are you talking about a specific line in the bill?
17.
Yeah, it's line 17.
Well, I think that since this is already current statute, the division director, who is specifically referred to here, I'm sure she can answer your question as far as the proof of identification.
Yep. Sorry, Mr. Chairman.
No worries. Go to your lifeline. Director, did you hear Senator Kawasaki's question? I think directed at you.
Through the chair, yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Kawasaki. I'm going to have to, right off the top of my head, I do not have that information available, but I am more than happy to provide that back to the committee, but like Mr. Appleby stated, this is current statute. If the division is not able to identify the identity of a voter, then they would not be registered at that point in time. I will definitely get back to you a more succinct response to that post-committee.
Sure. Thank you through the chair. Just, yeah, that, I guess that's my question is how it's done right now and whether they're, I mean, whether the proof of ID, I mean, I didn't need it and nobody asked me, but I guess is there a process for which that happens? Thanks.
And what I'm reading here, too, just as a probably part of that, is it does say may require, not shall. It's just per, just if they can't find it, they may require that. And you don't have to necessarily go here, Josh, but I know it's in the discussions we had this original request, I think kind of we worked through this with your office, with the Lieutenant Governor's office, because of the feedback that was provided of the trouble that the automatic registration was causing, the AVR, as was pointed out. Because we were registering people that shouldn't have been registered, felons and others was brought up. And we don't need to drill all the way down unless somebody has specific questions and wants to go down that rabbit hole. But that's how I remember this coming out of it. Was that, and if there's something you want to highlight on the some of the reasons behind that, feel free. But I know that that was part of the discussion that talking to both people in the Permanent Fund Division, as well as the Division of Elections, we just found out that was causing us some trouble. It's probably the easiest word on that. If there's further that you want to highlight, feel free.
Well, I think the only thing I'd like to add, Mr. Chairman, is that the Lieutenant Governor has been very clear that there's nothing automatic about the PFD automatic voter registration. It's more of a manual process than people believe. And so we've had about 5 years of experience with this process, and we believe that these changes, while not being 100% automatic, is still significantly better than hoping people come to the division to register to vote, because it's still being offered to them every time they apply for their PFD. We're just asking that it might be more appropriate to have them say, yes, I want this to change my voter registration.
Right. Fair enough. Just wanted to see if there was further amplifying information. Please continue.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In Section 6, this is adding two new subsections relating to the division's list of registered voters. It requires the division to adopt list maintenance regulations, requiring it to review certain records, including records of deceased voters, those convicted of felonies, those not qualified to vote, those registered in other states, number of registered voters compared to the number of eligible voters, and the voter registration data breaches. A lot of this is current practice. This is codifying current practice, making sure that it gets done, that it's not it's not forgotten.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I'm looking down reading too, so if I'm not looking, just do that. Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I actually recorded or got copies, screenshots of the voter registration, the automatic voter registration on the PFD. So when you apply, they actually do ask if you've been a felon or not, and then it says, hey, as a note, Alaska law doesn't allow voter registration if you answer yes to this question. A felony is defined as AS 1580-010. So I guess in the time in which this person would say, okay, yeah, I'm a felon, is there a process? I guess, and there might be a revenue question. Is there a process by which they filter this person out and say, oh, you answered yes to this question, you're a felon, you can't vote. So AVR, the next four pages of AVR questions are moot. And that might be a question for revenue and not for you. I don't know.
Mr. Chairman, I think Director Funumiai would probably know if it's a revenue question or something that she can answer.
Director? Director Funumiai, did you hear that question from Senator Kawasaki to Josh to defer to you?
I did, Mr. Chairman, and I failed to unmute my phone.
Oh, that makes more sense. Got it. Common occurrence. Go ahead, please.
This is Gail Funumiai from the Division of Elections. Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, the Department of Revenue currently sends to the Division of Elections anybody who applied for a PFD who would also be eligible to register to vote. And so those who have checked that they have been convicted of a felony involving moral turpitude would not be sent to the Division of Elections.
And then just to follow up on that.
Go ahead.
And then just to follow up, Director, do you verify that list? So if a person lies on this form, the MyAlaska form says I want to apply, And under the AVR provisions, they read the "have I been convicted of a felony," decide that they want to lie and say no. Is there a verification process for those folks?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, the division will take the information as provided by the voter on face value as they are attesting to it under penalty of perjury. The division does get regular information from the court system about individuals who have been convicted of felonies involving moral turpitude and is able to identify people who are currently registered that should not be registered, but there is not a reverse mechanism for that.
Thank you for that. And Senator Kawasaki, I'll add, we did talk about this last year. We brought that up because in discussions between employees of both divisions, Division of Election and Division of Revenue with the Permanent Fund Division, what we found was there really isn't a mechanism for cross-checking that. It's one of the reasons we wanted to put something in that would do that. Because whether somebody does it because they just want to see if they're qualified, maybe they don't realize they're not qualified, whatever the case may be, it was very clear to us in asking those questions on the record and with that brief research that we don't have a good mechanism, which is leads to one of the reasons why we're having this problem with people that end up in the system and then we're not cross-checking it and it causes trouble later. So there's probably multiple avenues to fix it, but it's clearly one of those things that we kind of, you know, you learn the lesson on and go, what do we do to make that better? So it is something that we also came through last year. Thank you. It's good. I'm glad you brought that up because it's good to get that out. Thanks.
So moving on, Mr. Chairman, on Section 6, the next subsection of Section 6 requires the division to select and consult a nationally recognized subject matter expert to audit our list of registered voters and issue a report every other year to the legislature. And so that should help provide insight to the members of the legislature of the status of our voter database and what we've done over the past year or the past 2 years and what we're going to do moving forward. Section 7 prohibits the division from accepting or spending private funds for the administration of elections. Certainly we heard a lot about that in the previous cycle. Not in Alaska. The Division of Elections doesn't have receipt authority. This just makes it abundantly clear that the division won't accept outside money. Section 8. This section and the following section, Section 9, concerns poll watchers. In terms of who is allowed to be a poll watcher, we felt that the statutes weren't clear enough in terms of allowing not just candidates or registered parties, but organizations and groups who are interested. For example, if you have a ballot initiative group and an opposition group to that ballot initiative, it wasn't clear that they could have certified poll watchers on their behalf. And so we made that very clear. And so we made sure that those definitions are expanded. So those people who have interests in how the election is run can actually have poll watchers there to make sure those interests are being that everything's being monitored and everything is being run the way it should.
I have a question here on this one, Josh. This came from, I don't believe he was a constituent. He wrote a very long response to this. I'm sure I probably got a very long response from him on SB 39 last year too. I don't remember it precisely, but he did have a question. And I told him I would do my best to try to bring those questions forward to have them answered. And it was specifically, if I'm summarizing, because I can't find my printout sheet of it, but I do remember some of his points. And this one was, if you were to have, say, a group, and I'm going to frame it exactly like he did, so I'm not changing his intent, was, well, what if you have one of these groups, like from Texas, that are all walking in, want to be poll watchers, and they got, you know, AR-15 strapped to their back? You know, how does that work out? Is the thing being intimidating for the poll workers? Or, and it could be a left or a right thing, right? I mean, you could have a bunch of people with Antifa shirts come in that are on the other side of the, you know, whatever. It could happen to anybody in any place. So what mechanism, or, and this could be for the director as well, as far as how we do this, that prevents that kind of situation where you have, or what authority is there within the statutes, and if we don't have it, maybe we need it, to prevent that kind of thing from happening? It's a broad question, but I thought it was a good one. I wanted to make sure it was presented.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman, and certainly, and it does sound like I'm bringing Gail in more than I should, but that would definitely be a question for her.
This wasn't specifically in the bill, so that makes sense, Director. If you heard the question, it kind of brings up the issue of it based on the language and how it works. So if you could maybe comment or talk us through that, I'd appreciate it.
Certainly, Gail Fadumi, I'm from the Division of Elections, Mr. Chairman. The state's been very fortunate and has not encountered a situation in my time working with the division of poll watchers, you know, trying to intimidate voters or causing significant concerns. The groups we work with are very flexible and understanding that also the polling place is not exactly conducive to having 50 people in at a time, and they've been willing to work with us in the past. So each group would be allowed to have a watcher in a precinct. I'm not sure if that answered your question completely, but we've had a very good working relationship, I believe, in allowing poll watchers at precincts.
So what if I'll try to make it again? And Gail, I'm trying to sorry, Director, have a pattern to use first names. What I'm trying to relay is the question was one of the concerns this gentleman had was we have this language here. Maybe it doesn't, and that's fine. If the mechanism doesn't do that, it was a concern he had, so we get it on the record and discuss it. Was that if this language, would it allow, I guess, is that a better way to ask it, a group, like I said, pick the political spectrum, a group of Antifa people, a group of, you know, far right Proud Boys or something, I don't know, these different terms I've heard, that could come in under the guise of this language change and intimidate poll workers, et cetera? Or is that something, and I know you said we haven't seen it, but I guess I'm asking you to speculate a little bit on would that make any changes that would allow that type of eventuality, or do we have the authority to say no, or do they have to call law enforcement? I mean, how does this play out? What's the impact?
Mr. Chairman, we also have Tom Flynn on the phone.
That's true. Thank you.
That might be an excellent question.
Director, either you or Tom Flynn or both of you, if you want to take a hack, I appreciate it.
This is Gail, and I'll just say quickly here that if there was a scene at a polling place, poll workers are – our first outreach would be to the police to help us, you know, to temper the situation down. But I'll let Tom speak to the legal aspects that you're talking about.
Tom, you're up.
Fair Shower, Tom Flynn again with the Department of Law. Hello again. Yes, I think just to add to what Gail said, Director Panini, I said, there would be other laws that would kick in if there were a scene like that at a polling place. You know, there's a law that prohibits electioneering, campaigning at polling places, and there are laws against voter harassment and intimidation. Those are state and federal laws. So there are other places in Title 15 and in federal law that would protect against that sort of thing. And this section wouldn't do anything to diminish the power of those other laws.
Okay, and just one quick, but then Senator Ramble, but I'm going to just follow up. I apologize if the gentleman's watching. I'm trying to ask the question correctly. I'm going to say it one more time, and we'll move on from it so we don't take too long. But I think his concern was looking at as the language reads and what was deleted was that could a biased person, you know, that is in the party precinct, whatever, come in and appoint a group of people that would be on their side of the aisle, for lack of a better term, that would then be able to intimidate the poll watchers and maybe make them, you know, less I don't know what the right word is here, but basically intimidated from doing their job correctly. So if you don't see that in here, that's fine. And I don't want to waste time on it, but I am trying to answer that question because I thought it was a good one.
Chair Shower, Tom Flynn again. I, for one, don't see that in here, but we could take a closer look at it for that potential issue.
Fair enough. I've spent a lot of time on that one. Senator Ramble, go ahead.
So basically, I think what I'm hearing from Chair Shower is basically the activists versus the observers and poll watchers, because if there's intimidating activists versus the poll watchers, it could be an issue, but it sounds like he's drilling down on that. But that was kind of the perspective that I was seeing in this, and I do think it potentially could be an issue. What I wanted to just divert just for a minute, I have two questions for Josh. One of them, and they're a little bit unrelated, but they're related. But first of all, I'm really super thankful that this bill is brought forth. So I want to get that on the record, that I think election integrity, and I know that Chair Shower has been working on this issue so hard, and a lot of us that have been on his committees have been working really hard on this. So I'm glad that it's at the forefront. But the two questions I have is, one, why have you guys not supported a forensic audit on this on this past election. If Chair Schauer doesn't want you to answer today, I understand, but it is something I do need an answer to, because there's a lot of people that are very concerned about the 2020 elections. He says he's not as concerned. Well, I know there's tons and tons of people that are, and I think it's nationwide. It's not just in Alaska, and if there's nothing to hide, then I don't understand why a forensic audit wasn't done. So that's a question, and it can't just be money, because we've had so much extra money come in. Two, I wanted to find out if the Crosby, you know, her overturning the ballot initiative, you know, the witness signature, you know, if you believe, you know, as people that are over the election, if that had any impact. And then the third one is a really softball question. It's who does your sectionals? Do you have to do them yourself, Josh, or do you get help with that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Reinbold, I'll answer the last one first. I get help on the sectionals. The Department of Law is very helpful in putting these together. In regards to the effect of the court ruling, I guess I would ask maybe a little bit more to ask you to be a little more specific in what you are asking in terms of did it affect. Fewer ballots were rejected because of the ruling. But, I mean, when you ask did it affect, maybe if you could be a little more specific in what you're asking.
Go ahead.
Through the chair. Just if it increased potential ballot harvesting, because I've never run into what I ran into when I was in Muldoon. I would run into huge groups of outsiders that were, you know, collecting ballots and bragging about it. I've never seen it, and I've been involved in campaigns. My mom, since I was 5 years old with Senator Stevens, was my very first one. So it's just something I've never, ever seen before. So her overturning what we put into law, you know, Judge Crosby, many are concerned that did have an impact on the outcomes. You may not want to answer that, but it is a deep concern. But sometime in this process, I want to get an opinion in regards to that, if you're comfortable or not. And then the third one, go ahead. Why don't you answer that, and then I'll get to my final.
What I'll do is I'll be happy to get you a more significant response on what we saw in terms of the results, if we can attribute that to the waiver of the signature witness or not. I'd be happy to put that together for you.
Yeah.
And then I would also be happy to get with the Lieutenant Governor and get his response to your question on the forensic audit. I'd be happy to do that for you.
Okay.
He's the policy level. I'll go ahead and not put the staff on the spot, but we'll make that official request from us to the Lieutenant Governor for an answer.
Absolutely.
As it was asked. Go ahead.
Sounds great, because those are just issues, you know, because we work so hard to get something through. It takes 60 people, and, you know, the governor can veto the executive branch, but then with one judge can, you know, strike it down. To me, it just didn't seem fair or right, and many people do believe it had significant impacts on the 2020 election. So I think those two things coupled. I also just want to, not today, but at a future date, want to see what the best of your bill and their bill, you know, I just think that's a really good opportunity to highlight, you know, what is similar, and then what are the best of the best, and choose from those two. And I also want to apologize. A very important ledge budget and audit meeting was scheduled for 4:30, and there's a lot of documents to read and confidential documents. And because I'm on the Criminal Justice Commission, I was literally booked, like triple booked, I think, this afternoon with official duties. And I apologize that I do have to walk out.
There it is.
So
thanks for being there for the quorum, Senator. We'll see you later. Before you get there, I just want to make one quick comment on that, because I know Senator Ramble said it. I'm not concerned, and I don't want it to be left that way like I wasn't concerned. I have my concerns, or I wouldn't be doing this, you know, with the election system, including how the 2020, you know, election went. And back for the terminology perspective, it's not a forensic audit, and it's okay, because I'm still doing it too, but it's a risk-limiting audit. I did ask for that. You know, we had these discussions. We were told that money and other issues, we should do it. And the answer from, you know, the legislature asking the question was, we're not going to do it, not going to provide the money. So it's not that some of us weren't concerned about it, didn't want to see the data, because where there's smoke, is there fire or not? I needed that data, like the report, the discussions we've had. I need to know what to do. And if I don't have good data, it's really hard for me to have good policy. So I want to be clear on that. I do agree with Senator Reinbold that the data is what I'm looking for. And we did ask those questions on both of those for what is really a risk-limiting audit. We were basically denied. So I just want that to be clear on the record. That's all. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. And I'm sorry, Senator Kawasaki, I think you're up.
I did have a question on Section 8. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, some of the part that was deleted relates to the idea that you have to have counting or the place of voting in a full view of action so that the folks there, the poll watcher or the person who's watching the ballot counts as they go through, has a full view of action. That's been deleted, and I don't know if it may have been replaced somewhere else.
Mr. Chairman, Sarah Kawasaki, I'd be happy to double-check that. It could have been one of those things when you delete sections and you forget to add back in, but I'd be happy to really get into that and make sure that it was either specifically removed or accidentally, and I'll find out for you.
That's a good question because, quite frankly, as Senator Kawasaki pointed out, this is about transparency. And one of the things I think we have to do for both sides to restore faith is go, there's complete transparency. What algorithm was used? You know, poll watchers there to see everything, all that stuff. Because this is going to help people from diving down the rabbit holes of going conspiracy and this and that, both sides, whatever. I'm tired of that. So what do we need to do to make sure that people can have faith and go, oh, look, it's all out there for everybody to see. Nothing to hide here. You don't have to like the results, but at least you got to trust them. So that's a great question, and I would like a follow-up because that could have been one. It's happened before. So
yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And you know, there was a question as to whether – I can't remember what state it was as they were trying to do the recount. They had to stand like a certain number of feet away. I can tell you, our director, we had screens up, plastic screens, and we could stand right there. And we could hear what they were saying, and we had a person say, so the people who are counting ballots said so-and-so's name out loud. We could look at our list just to see if it's the same. Everybody had the same chance. And it, literally, we were just steps away, and they did it with protection also. And I thought that was done really well. I just don't want to see a place where – in the other state that I'm talking about, they had to stand like 20 feet away, so they couldn't really see anything. They couldn't tell. And so I hope it's somewhere else up. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, he actually might be referring to the Anchorage election most recently.
Yeah.
There was issue of
there was
poll watchers having to use binoculars, I believe.
There was. I remember that, and that's one of the things we talked about, too, when municipalities do things. We have to be very careful because they can – do their own thing in a sense, and they're using our data. And one thing I think we as a legislature state want to be careful of is a municipality doesn't go off on its own using our stuff, and we're going, hey, you got to do better than that. You can't do that to your people. It's got to be fair and balanced for all to see because this works both ways. It can affect both sides. I will tell you that we were in discussion earlier today about Colorado because we pulled some of the things we had in our bill were best practices from Colorado because we thought they did some pretty good things. And that's a, you know, both sides were looking at that and going, oh, there's some good things here. One of them is this issue of they have 24-hour lockdown where they have cameras and everything available 24/7. You cannot not have it. There can't be that, well, we're closed for the night, and then people are going in the side door, because I know that was an allegation made in Anchorage that had happened, but they do this so it is 24/7 until it's over. You cannot stop the cameras going so everybody sees everything, and all sides have access to it. And something like that we're considering because that's a good, you know, deterrent for anybody to do this, and everybody has full access. Why not? What are we afraid of? There's nothing to hide. So please continue.
And just to put a finer point on that, Mr. Chairman, as you know, when you have these big bills, sometimes sections don't get where they should be. And so it certainly, I can't imagine that it was a specific intent to remove that, but I'll definitely get to the bottom, Senator Kawasaki, and let you know.
Thank you.
I believe that we're on Section 10, creating and publicizing the toll-free election offense hotline.
Senator Costello.
Oh, thank you. So I like the inclusion of the 800 number and that it has to be publicized. My question has to do with the assumption made that something will be done with the complaint. There's nothing, it doesn't say here that serious complaints will be investigated or that these issues will be turned over to somebody. It doesn't say who listens to it or even if anything happens. So I was curious about that and if it would be something that we could work together to figure out whether or not we close that circle. And then will the issues be made public so that the public can see what issues are brought up or not? And then whose responsibility is it to look into it? And will the hotline be monitored, you know, throughout the process, or will these, you know, where's the accountability is kind of what I'm saying. I mean, I like the idea of a hotline. People can call and it's anonymous, but where's where can we make this more accountable so that something will happen and people just don't say, well, yeah, you know, you can call this 800 number, but we have no idea, you know, what happens to the information.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think that's an excellent point. And getting more specific on this particular section is something we'd be happy to work with you on.
And I will tell you, Senator Costello, and follow up that we actually had a larger section of this in the bill that we introduced last year. We kind of skinnied that down because we dropped out a lot of things because there was so much pushback. So we actually had a more robust section of that that delineated these things a little more for that very reason, because nobody, I don't think anybody was against the idea of a hotline so that you could report that. But we had discussed training for law enforcement, so they had more because they get really virtually nothing. Having the sense of like an IG and Inspector General, a much bigger thing, but having somebody that was directed to do this and the time frame, how long it would be monitored for, et cetera. So perhaps that's something we can look at, amending it if anybody is interested in doing that, where we could put some of that robustness back into that section.
Mr. Chairman, that'd be great. Best not to reinvent the wheel.
All right, Krabby. Thanks.
Section 11 prohibits election officials and others from providing assistance at the polls from influence the voting decision of those they are assisting. This came out of a conversation of a concern, especially given this new way of voting in the general election, that we wanted to make it clear that poll workers are there to help. They are not there to influence, and they're not there to vote for the voter. And so this is very specific in saying you can help, but you can't influence a person's vote.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
Perhaps for you or Director Funami, and this relates to ballot measure 2, we came up with ranked choice voting. So it kind of talks about, you know, that this is, we had this discussion the other day. It's pretty complicated, and it's, you know, the first time there's going to be a lot of questions, especially in person. Whatever happens to people with absentee, oh, well, at home. I don't know how you're going to get help, and that's a little tougher. But if you're in the ballot or if you're in the in-person voting area and you want help, they're really not supposed to help, really, and certainly assisting them in how they vote. And I'm wondering, do we have conflict here because they're not supposed to provide that influence on how to vote, but they're going to have to tell them how to put their bubbles and how to put their people here and how they're actually kind of voting. And I know that's maybe splitting hairs a little bit, but I see a potential conflict or challenge to this here and how those two things may be in conflict. Can somebody, either Department of Law, Director, or Josh yourself, that wants to take a stab at that a little?
Mr. Chairman, in assisting a voter and showing them how to vote, I can pull a sample ballot and fill that out and say this is how this works without actually touching their ballot or doing anything with their official ballot. So that would be the way you can provide assistance without influencing their vote. You just pull the sample ballot and you say, you know, here's the 1, 2, 3, 4. And so I think they can achieve the help without crossing the line into influencing.
Okay. It just seems like that could be a little bit contentious for somebody. And what I would imagine is somebody that wants a lot of help and doesn't understand it and goes, no, tell me where I need to put my vote for X, right in front of everybody. I want to know where to put vote for this candidate and that candidate and which bubble. And it seems like we're getting kind of tight. I understand why it would be happening, and I'm not saying there's anything malicious behind it. I'm saying, but are you setting up the poll worker to potentially get themselves in trouble if somebody makes an accusation that, you know, they're helping or they did that? And so I would like to know, maybe that's a Department of Law question, or you can get back to us if it's something you want to discuss. I'm concerned here, Tom, for the poll worker themselves. Is there conflict between these that's going to get a poll worker in trouble? That's what I'm asking, between the two new laws or how it would be written there.
Chair Schauer, Tom Flynn again. The existing portion of this statute requires poll workers to give assistance, if requested, and so that will continue. And I think to give an example of the sort of assistance that might be, a voter might get an error message that says, too many skipped votes, something like that. And what the poll worker can do is explain what that means in a way that doesn't influence the voting choice at all. And actually, to go to those other provisions against electioneering at the polling places, those all remain and those apply even with more force to poll workers. So they'll still be prevented from influencing voters how they choose who they want to vote.
Okay. Well, it's on the record here. If somebody gets in trouble, they can go back and the court can look at the intent to use as your defense if something happens here. So I just want to make sure we're not setting somebody up to fail. Thank you. Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. And I just don't have the statutes in front of me, but this section 11 and title 15, deals specifically with at the poll and not necessarily absentee ballots received at a home.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. I think that was, are you referring to my comment?
Through the chair. No, I was just asking the question. So if a ballot came home, an absentee ballot came home, my mom asked me who I should vote for, am I not supposed to do that?
Mr. Chairman, you wouldn't be serving in the role of an election worker. So
no, it's good it's a good clarifying question on the record, so people understand. Senator Costello.
So I was just curious, what is the plan, or do we have one for how to educate the election workers on the ranked choice voting? Because it's not necessarily something you hear a presentation once and all of a sudden you understand. Has there been any discussion of that in the bill, or
Mr. Chairman, certainly the director can explain how the division is moving forward with money that's already been appropriated, and her plans for education. It's pretty robust at this point, and I'll let Gail get into the specifics. And we have also submitted a supplemental budget request for additional funds to increase our efforts in educating the public as well.
Mr. Chair, that's fine if I have a discussion with Ms. Panumi later, because it's not addressed in the bill, and I'd like to get through the bill.
Sounds good. Perfect. All right. Continue, please. Section 13, I think.
Actually, I think we're on 12, Mr. Chairman.
12, you're right. Yep. Thank you.
This comes from your bill. I don't want to skip section 12.
Oh, dear.
This requires the division to adopt regulations for the precinct ballot count and how ballots are handled once the precincts are closed, and certainly the chairman and his staff identified this issue of ballots being destroyed at the precinct level. This changes that process. Again, making it more transparent and accountable.
Thank you, Josh. This was one that we had through the research that we basically found that there was a lot of variation between different places and how things were being done. So we go back to, as opposed to putting, for example, Director Funamiai in the hot seat and having direct policy, and then sometimes say, well, why'd you do that? And the next administration changes it, or the next director. We feel we want to get as away from as many of those policy decisions as possible, so they don't have to answer to that. It should be our job to create the statutes and the governing guidance. And so this was just one of those, go, let's make it consistent, take it out of different places' hands and go, this is how it's going to be, and it's going to be one thing and done. So that was the reason for it. Pretty simple one, but just it's more of a codification of how we should do business. Thank you.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. Section 13, this gets back to the risk-limiting audit concept that we talked about, and expands the ability of the division to count more than one precinct if they feel it's necessary. Section 14 shortens the retention period of election materials from a current 4 years to a federally required 22 months. And we kind of went around on this one about why would you want to shorten the retention period? Well, if you haven't figured it out after 22 months, there's no court case or anything else that's going to go back and relitigate an election after 22 months. And so consistency with the federal law is where that number came from. Section 15 requires the division to provide absentee voter instructions on how to use the free online system for tracking the absentee ballots, which you'll see is created in Section 23. Just the way statutes, bills are drafted, you have to go by the order of statutes. So it kind of puts the cart before the horse a little bit. But we create the tracking for absentee ballots in Section 23. Section 15 says we need to provide voters those instructions. Section 16 requires a division to provide posted page return envelopes for absentee ballots. This is a bit of a contentious issue, and we're still working through, the different aspects of it. There's a concern that if you preprint the postage on the return of the absentee ballots, you are going to avoid getting postmarks from the post office. And so we're going to and are in touch with the USPS trying to find out exactly what the rules are, what will happen if we do this. And so it's in the bill, but it still needs some additional, it's not as refined as we'd like it to be at this point. Mr. Chairman, but we are working on
that's it. Also, as you remember, Josh, we had this discussion. This is one of the reasons for pushing also for ballot chain of custody, so that we had that trail so we can know and see that. And if it becomes a question ballot, for example, that comes back based on the timing or no watermark, when was it sent? When should it have been there? Because this has happened. We already have this on the record. We know it happens. So we got to get past that, because what we can't have is this is what do they call it, the Nagy Act. Don't get Nagy Act. It was because it happened up in, I think it was District 40 years ago, and it's still an issue they talk about there. So how do we account for that and make sure that if we're going to mail or put the poster, which I'm a fan of, how do we make sure coming back we don't end up with, you know, 1,000 ballots that show up afterwards and we have no way to prove it? Well, now you get into a whole court battle, and so we want to prevent that. So there's different ways, including the ballot tracking or, you know, chain of custody would be a good one, some system that allows us to be able to go back and look for that. But that is the ongoing question. How do we put that into statute guidance, and what do we use for it?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that's exactly right. So the idea is in the bill. It's still a little bit not as refined as we'd like it to be. Certainly, City Borough of Juneau ran into this problem with their mail-in election. So we're hoping to find the solution as we get down the road in the discussion on issues like this.
My staffer here was one of those people whose vote didn't count in the general election because of the postmark date. So it's a real concern for people to know you're actually disenfranchising votes and their vote does not count because of that problem. So
and if we can actually find an elegant solution to this, I think that it'll only make the bill stronger.
Thank you. Question.
Senator Costello.
Is there any evidence that individuals are not voting because they're not able to locate a stamp or afford a stamp? I mean, is this a problem that doesn't exist?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Costello, I don't have a specific voter that's contacted me and said I would have voted if it weren't for a darn stamp. So I don't have that. But we do have anecdotal evidence that you want to make it as easy as possible to vote. And so if a stamp is what's preventing you from voting, it seems like a very easy fix. If it is indeed an easy fix, and again, that's kind of the roughness of this idea, it might not be as easy as we think, but we need to find out.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
And I understand the straightforwardness of the comment. You know, you want to make it as easy as possible, but we always have to weigh the cost benefit in this job, and if the risk is that you're going to have ballots that are postmarked or would have been postmarked after the election day, is that a worse scenario where you're counting ballots for folks that sent them in late versus what are we gaining? We are gaining the ease of, you know, not having to search for a stamp and what have you. But I do think it's worth, you know, trying to figure out, because I think at the end of the day you don't want the problem that Juneau had, and I'm curious to know what they did about it.
I don't know the answer to that, unless Director Fanamiai has any information on what Juneau did about the problem or anywhere else.
Mr. Chairman, there were several thousand ballots that were not counted. That's how Juneau dealt with it. And I don't know that they've gone around and have made changes to their process yet, but it's an excellent point, Senator. The cost cannot outweigh the benefits in this situation. But we don't yet know what those costs are or what the benefits would be, and we need to get to the bottom of that.
I would hate my question to be misinterpreted that I am somehow not in support of making it as easy as possible to vote by having the postage paid. Mm-hmm. But if thousands of ballots weren't counted, apparently because they didn't know when they were mailed, that to me is a huge problem, and I do appreciate that we're having this conversation.
Yeah, and that is the issue. You have to know it's got to follow the law, and if the law says it's got to be by a certain date, it doesn't show up, and there's no postmark. Guess what happens to it? Gone. So we want to try to prevent that, and there may be some methods we can. Senator Hall, Senator Cobb, still good? Yeah. Senator Hall,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question: did we look at across the states how many other states provide postage paid or prepaid ballots? I don't really see it's a big problem, but I just hate to think we're, you know, cutting edge technology here or something, or we're reinventing the wheel or something.
Through the chair, Senator Holland, many jurisdictions pay for the postage. And if you'd like, I can get a breakdown, but I believe it's more common to have the postage paid than not. But I would have to, I can get that for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious.
Good
question. Senator Kawasaki.
Yeah, so thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this is a piece of mail that's postage paid by Division of Elections, and it doesn't get stamped, so I get that issue. So we can't be the only state in the nation that had this problem, right? I guess how do other states deal with the problem of having a ballot that's stamped, or a ballot so that they can recognize that it was actually sent out before the correct date? There must be another state out there.
Mr. Chairman, that's exactly what we need to research, is have other states found a solution. If they found the solution, then, you know, again, not wanting to reinvent the wheel, we'll just copy what they did.
Good questions. And like I said, we also are asking the Postal Service for research on the postmarking and how that would work. And is there an option that we have available to us and how that might tie in, like I said, with ballot chain of custody and the other programs we're looking at to track those. So there could be an elegant solution, just don't know yet.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much. And we knew putting this section in would create this conversation, but we believe it's a conversation that's worth having. Section 17 prohibits the division from sending absentee ballots to voters who don't request them. This is current statute. It's current practice. But this makes it perfectly clear that if you don't request a ballot, you will not receive one from the state of Alaska. Okay. Section 18 allows voters to request absentee ballots for up to 4 years. There is a discussion out there to create a permanent absentee application. Much like the situation that we find with the automatic PFD registration, we feel that a permanent absentee would keep people on the voter rolls longer than they need to be. And so we believe that a two-election cycle absentee ballot term is something that is a good place to begin the discussion. So, Section 19, this directs the division to begin reviewing absentee ballot certificates 10 days before the election. Current statute says that the division can begin reviewing 7 days. As we saw in 2020, the absolute increase in absentee ballot applications, 10 days versus 7, gives us more time to process those applications so they can be counted faster.
Okay, and I would also add that this comes partially from Colorado with best practices. We were looking at this as well, trying to move the timeline forward because of the delay to the afterward. Mm-hmm. So still allowing people the option to turn in and looking at curing and all the other things, but trying to get them moving so that we have this timeline and we're not waiting for 2 weeks after the election, which we're going to be close to already with ranked choice voting, waiting on the actual election results to know. So this is part of that whole, I think, move it forward. And so anyways, okay. Yeah, sir. I'm sorry.
Thank you. Can I just ask a question about the process? So a person will get an absentee ballot, they'll send it in, the teams at the regional places will sort of set them up in, and do they separate the ballot from the ballot envelope, or is that a process that's done later?
Mr. Chairman, certainly the director would be happy to answer that question specifically for Senator Kawasaki.
Director.
Gail Panumi, I'm from the Division of Elections. Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, when by-mail ballots are received at one of the five regional offices, they stay, they're logged by staff, and then they are reviewed at a later point in time by the bipartisan absentee review board, and they are not opened and the ballot is not removed from the envelope until the bipartisan review board has gone through each envelope received to determine and certify that voter is eligible to have cast that ballot.
That's perfect. Okay. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks, Josh. Continue.
Sections 20, 21, and 22 all specifically deal with signature matching and how it would happen, whether or not a mismatched signature could disqualify a ballot. It also gets into, as we move into into Section 23, we have the absentee ballot tracking system and the cure process. This is one concept of the cure process. This is another section that we feel is going to require additional discussions in terms of length of time, and really, can we create a system that we can apply equally to every Alaskan. Many of the concerns that have been brought up is that we might come up with a cure process that will be fine in Anchorage, but is unworkable for the rest of the state. And so we have to come up with a cure process that we can apply equally to every voter across the state. We believe this is a good starting point. We know this is not where we're going to end, Mr. Chairman.
And Josh, quick question for Section 20, just kind of circling back there, my old pull of gin here, is this where it's going to be the direction to implement a forensic signature? And I think that is the correct term on this one, a forensic signature check like Anchorage currently does, but we're talking about doing that. So is this where it would be codified in this section?
These sections kind of combined give the division the ability to not only do something like what Anchorage does, but go beyond that and actually use software.
Right. Not because Anchorage actually does, they get training, but it's just a human. It's not actually a machine checking against the database of a different signature.
Yes, sir.
So this is the one that's going to do that. Is that it? Because I read it as shall. That's for,
yes.
So the direction is they shall implement this, correct?
Yes. And if you look to the other sections, for example, Section 22, the signature verification process will include the use of signature verification software.
Okay.
And gives the division the ability to write the regs about how that's actually going to work at the regional level.
I know there's a cost with that, and I just want to point that out because that's one of the things I think that takes some of the angst away from those that, you know, don't trust the mail-in and absentee and all that kind of stuff. And we're trying to find ways to assuage people's concerns, knowing that it's going to be something that's actually checked against real signatures over time from different databases. It's one of the things, at least personally, I know I said, hey, if we're going to do that, at least let's make sure we validate it. It makes me feel a little more secure in it. So I think that's a positive step personally in Senator Kawasaki, I think.
Yeah, and I first wanted to say that the ballot signature thing is really cool. There were a couple ballots that came in. Some of the ballots didn't match. The signature obviously didn't match, so we contested it. And they have a screen up, and it matches a signature that they have on file versus the signature that's there, and you could like pretty much say that that's not a signature that is there. A lot of cases, it was the person signing, the wife probably signing for the husband. So, I mean, it wasn't automated, but it was pretty darn well done during the vote watching, the vote verification process. I did have a question as to where that signature came from, though. Because I signed for my driver's license, I don't know, 30 years ago, and I don't know, my signature's changed a little bit, and it's gotten a little floppy. So I guess, is it that signature, or is there another?
I think there's multiples that they were looking at, but I will ask the director of Phenomia, because I believe we had this discussion about how they could, the software can look at multiples, and there's some variation there based on time and whatnot, but director?
I'm Gail Fidumiai from the Division of Elections. Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, are you referring to the Municipality of Anchorage process?
No, this was through the chair, Director Fidumiai. This was actually in Fairbanks at that division when they were when we were going through ballot certification, absentee ballot certification. So they were looking at the signatures on the outside, and they had an example, and then they typed the person's name in, and it flashed up on the screen, and they could compare visually whether those were actually the case. 2020 election.
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, those signatures would have been signatures that voters have submitted to the Division of Elections on various documents. So those signatures would have been signatures the Division of Elections had in their possession. And they could be from paper copies that came in of voter registration forms, absentee by mail applications, or the signature on file with DMV, as we know, we also get many signatures, many voter registration processed through DMV, and we capture those signatures as well.
I think that was the question I had too, Senator Kawasaki, is that there was multiple databases, so it wasn't going to be like a one time, you know, you did this at 18 and changed and you look very different, you know, 30 years later. There was some ability to capture multiples out of this to make sure it's not a one, you know, you're causing this, because you would cause a spike in that case, so obviously a lot of, you know, question ballots in that case. The other part, too, that I want to put on the record here to discuss this is one of the concerns people also had is, you know, we talked about, like, on the record, well, you can have an X and a no, and we pretty much prima facie, you know, accept that depending on what happens. And knowing that you'd have to have somebody that could actually make that signature, you know, it's one more step in the process of going, nah, you can't just do that with voter identification data and then, like, request one. It's going to have to –
It's just one more thing that's kind of a, that security cross-check. So I just wanted to put that out there that it was a helpful step, we thought. Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I did have a question about that in particular. When I worked at the hospital and I did a lot of power of attorneys, we did people could sign an X, and it was in a lot of cases it was a person who just didn't have had mobility issues or something like that, and we asked them to sign anyway. So I guess my question has more to do with the next sections dealing with ballot carrying. Is you get a signature in, a person maybe a person got married to a different person's last name, that person, so they sign their name completely different. Is that part of the ballot carrying process, and will the person who's looking at the ballot say, this needs to be flagged, this person has an opportunity to verify that they actually did sign this, or again, it's the person who broke their arm and then they signed with an X instead of their former signature. Is that part of the process in hearing, or will it be?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kawasaki, as we define what voters can do to cure their ballots, all of those situations do come to mind, yes.
And I think, and I know we did discuss this last year when we were going through this, because this was one of those things you really got to spend time on, was that very question, is that there will be some variability. Worst case, it gets a question ballot, and then they have a chance to come back when we go to curing to make sure that they don't get tossed, because that's one of the things that could happen, right? They could actually do that, and they go, that's not, you know, that's a spaghetti stain. That's not a signature, and out it goes, and we want to make sure that doesn't happen. So by using the signature verification process, the software, it highlights it. It would give them my understanding of what we were intending to do is it would then highlight it. They would take a look at it, and they would make a human would now look at it and go, oh, okay, we need to contact this person because clearly there's something that's not right. Something is non-standard. So that was how I envisioned it going anyways. And I assume we're still headed down that path. And I apologize, Senator Kyle. Stella was asking earlier, and I forgot her.
Thank you. So page 9, line 15, the way that the current statute is written, it says that an absentee ballot may not be counted if, and then it lists a bunch of things. And I just, my question is, should that may in fact be shall? Because the way it's written, the voter can fail to properly execute the certificate and it still can be counted because the word is may instead of shall. So since it's may, my question is, whose decision is it that ballots can show up that are not attested, not postmarked on or before the date of election, and make the decision that it could actually still be counted?
Mr. Chairman, I think Tom Flynn from the Department of Law can address the terminology of may not be counted.
Tom?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, this is Tom Flynn again. So as a matter of statutory construction, may not is actually obligatory here. It's mandatory, so it means they will not be counted.
And can Ms. Fanumiai verify that that's how it's interpreted? Because I often see shall, and it seems shall is a little more clear.
Through the chair, Gail Fidumiai, Division of Elections, through the chair, Senator Costello, the Division of Elections has been following the statute as written that the ballots are not counted based on those circumstances listed below.
Thank you for that.
Thank you. I understand that confusion. It is often those things we look for. May versus shall can get, directing guidance versus the option. So, but I also understand what the Department of Law is saying, and we have that on the record now for showing the intent. And I just want to say that we do have Representative Nelson with us. He's been in here, and we do have an intent to get to him because he's got a bill. We're going to try to get through this as best we can, but just let everybody know he's been waiting for a while. And we will get to you, and I'm not going to forget you, so just FYI. Sarah Holland, do you have a question? Okay. Please continue, John.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 24 requires the division to adopt regulations for routine forensic examinations and strict chain of custody protocols for the precinct tabulators. And again, this gets back to the fundamental question that you brought up on several occasions of finding and clearly defining forensic examination. And so that's a discussion that definitely needs to be, that we need to have so that when we use that term, we know what we're talking about.
And that may, in this case, Josh, forensic for a computer, that may be the right terminology here if we're going to check the computers, because we had this discussion earlier today, again, multiple discussions, but we believe we've been, actually, I think we do have the answer now, was given back, is that did we ever test the machines? Because that was something out of that report that kind of just backhanded got to us, and the answer is we never really did. And so this is one of the things we want to make sure that we do, because this is back to, you know, providing people that confidence with the algorithms, going, you know what, got to test them. Got to show the algorithm, got to have everything out there so everybody can see it and it's totally transparent. We're going to shut that down. No more people not trusting it because of at least those factors, because we can control that. There's some things we can't. So I think this is a good one because this pushes that out and says, no, we're going to do this. There's no option that it's going to happen. And I think that helps. So just for clarification on the record of where we are with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 25, actually section 25 through 28. These are the new election offenses. They include unlawful interference, such as ballot harvesting, election fraud, and election official misconduct. And these are, you know, these are clearly stating when you conduct these activities, these are illegal activities. Section 29, again, kind of requires the official election pamphlet to include the election offense hotline. It's amazing how all the little things, and we've seen this over the years in bills, you kind of think to yourself, do we really need to do that? And yeah, we need to have it in there. Section 30, this gets back to what the chairman was talking about in terms of requiring 4 hours of training for public safety officers about election offenses. And so if they are called upon to do the investigation, they've at least had some exposure on what it is the offenses are and what constitute what offense.
And I would like to highlight that for the record again, because I did it last year, and we'll say it one more time. After the 2020 election, all this information came into us, right? And I said, there's a lot of stuff here. It's not my lane. Don't know what to do with this. I took all that information. I turned it over to ABI. They did whatever they did, and that kind of disappeared into the bowels of government. I don't know. But nothing ever came back. You know, there was a couple issues. There are a couple cases. So there was some, you know, but whatever. The point being is that the reason that we included this is after that discussion, and in discussion with the investigators, they were very clear. I'm like, well, this isn't our lane. We don't really do this. We don't really have any training in this. I'm like, okay, well, that's a little scary. These are the guys we're turning stuff over to that really don't know what to look at. So it seemed reasonable to ask our law enforcement, if you're going to ask them to investigate the potential of some crime or any other thing that's happening, they ought to know and understand that particular topic, and we don't do that. So that's all this is, and it's just to make sure that we're not putting them into a square corner and asking them to do something. And that, quite frankly, came from direct conversations I had with them and their feedback on that, going, this is not something we do. So for what it's worth, it's probably appropriate to make sure they have the resources they need. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kawasaki was first.
Okay.
Senator Costello. Oh. Do that way.
Thank you. So on this section, page 18, the teacher in me just has to make this comment. I'm so sorry. I apologize in advance. When you say that, you know, a certain number of hours is significant or adequate in order for somebody to understand something, it takes people different periods of time, you know. And so what's important actually is not how long somebody spent learning or how quickly they learned it, but that they learned it. And so I might suggest that we work together to figure out a way to include in that, in those lines at the beginning of page 18, that that they demonstrates an understanding of, because they can take the 4 hours and then not have to even show that they understand it, and I just think that makes it a little stronger to do that. So anyway, I'd be happy to work with you on that.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's an excellent recommendation.
As I would say, I feel strongly both ways. Whatever works.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator.
Whatever it takes for them to get the training they need to have a resource when we ask them to do something. That's all. It's great feedback. Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Kawasaki, you were up.
Yep, sorry, and I hate to backtrack, but just because, and I think this is actually the same that is written in your bill. And
where
page
at?
14, section 25.
Give me a second, please.
This is relating to who can possess a ballot.
Hold on a sec. Let's catch back up to you real quick. Page 14, Seth?
Yeah.
And that's what mine?
Basically, it's the new
top of it.
And I think it's something that's similar in your bill, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, yep.
And I just wanted to hear.
It is similar to Chairman's bill. Yes.
So I just wanted to hear that. So League Women Voters, for instance, is a group that goes out. They they have sort of an organized drive to pick up ballots at the seniors at the the Pioneers home. I know there's volunteers that have done that. They don't do it for any money or anything like that, but would this prevent that group from participating in the way they did in 2020 or any previous election? They've done it for years and years.
Mr. Chairman, I believe this language would prevent that, yes.
So before we get to that, and if you want to go to Department of Law or get another read on that, I'll say this. You know this, you were involved in the discussions. We were more than willing, because we actually started toning that down because we were trying to find a method. Look, to make the bottom line intent, what we're trying to prevent is people being flown up here, being paid to walk through neighborhoods and canvas for people's ballots that kind of maybe exceeds the intent of somebody, you know, that's just trying to help, somebody that maybe senior citizens and others. So that was the goal, and we started trying to manipulate that language. We got pretty close to that, I think, last year, and it just kind of died off with everything that happened. So I am willing to work on this as well with Senator Kawasaki, the administration, to find maybe the updated language, because I think we had different language in there, that does not prevent family, for example, from helping us, mom and dad for our grandma and grandpa to get their ballots. It does not prevent people that are in good faith trying to help people that need help to make sure they get their ballots collected and taken and mailed away. You got to be careful of, you know, what people do with, you know, helping and stuff, because there are some court cases, we looked those up, of people getting in trouble for that down south, other states. But that really is the intent, is to prevent professional ballot harvesters. That's what I want to get to, and I think that's a valid concern because we've seen legal court cases of people doing it and doing it with malicious intent. So that if we can find a way to get to that, I'm game, because that was what we were trying to do, and there are ways to make sure. And we don't want to prevent, that was the goal, because we found out it kind of did, we thought, was prevent certain people from helping others, that there's no malicious intent there. So I'm very open to how we get to that point of preventing professional ballot harvesting from taking place in Alaska.
Mr. Chairman, and we'd be welcome to work with you and Senator Kawasaki's office in getting to that language that works.
Great. Good on that one?
Yes.
Yep. Okay, so I think we're back to, I don't know where we were.
Okay, we are getting close to the finish.
All right.
Sections 31 and 32 we discussed in the previous section 5 through 8 in terms of the PFD language. Section 33, where are we at here? And this is a section that allows voters that provides utility bills, government documents, and different forms of identification other than an ID to vote. This is a discussion that we believe needs to happen. We don't see a lot of Chugach Electric bills being presented at the polls, but we want to find a method that makes the most sense. I mean, you want to accept tribal IDs, you accept regular state IDs, student IDs, photo IDs, different types of identification. But then, you know, our statutes, we feel at this point, maybe just a tad too broad. And so that's where we want to start in that discussion here in Section 33.
Senator Holland?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I might have seen someone here where hunting and fishing licenses are accepted as forms of ID. Mm-hmm. And pardon? I wasn't quite sure where I saw that.
We had talked about that before because it was in current statute, and we were actually, in our bill, we were attempting to delete it. The point was being is that because you can get that anywhere, anybody can have it, it was one of those, okay, well, what's the cross-check? What's the verification from a government entity that said this is a valid form of proving you are who you are, whatever methods we agreed to? And we thought that was one of the ones, kind of like the others, back to best practices from states we looked at down south. So, well, don't do that, because you have to, there's no way to verify that. Who verifies that? Nobody's actually checking, you know, a clerk at the gas station, you can get it, right? And then you can go vote with it. Or did you pick that up out of the garbage, you know, somebody's address, and you go vote in their state? So it's more nuanced than that, but that was kind of the general intent, was to go, what are the best practice options for ensuring somebody's ID? And for example, we include a tribal ID. And I know there's some questions even some people on the left had about that, believe it or not, about, well, tribal ID, what if they're a tribal member of Alaska but they live in Seattle? That could happen. But, you know, so there are some things that we have to continue to work on to try to get it as tight as we can. But that was At least if that makes sense, Senator, that was intended.
My apologies. I'm not quite sure where I saw it. I know I saw it today, but we look at a lot of legislation.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Holland, that's exactly the reason we put this section in there is to continue that conversation and what's going to work for voters in Alaska.
So this is where we go back to where we were talking about, like, using these with, you know, multi-factor authentication, because pretty much everybody does it every day. Not everybody in the bush, another plan. I get that, and that's why we – in the bill, we had this as a method, almost like a pilot program to get people used to it. You got to do this to go to the airport and scan your QR code or other things you do in the bank, multi-factor, you got to call them in. And some people made fun of it and pushed back. And I go, well, we understand we can't give that to everybody. So everybody can still use tribal ID. They can use other forms of things. Not trying to limit it, trying to move us into the 21st century, basically, on this. Still using the old stuff, but what are better ways? That was really our intent with this. And that kind of exploded into a, you know, anyways. But, okay, copy. Enough on that one. Senator Costello.
Well, I'm actually jumping ahead a little bit. And my question's for Tom Flynn. It's on page 19, line 12. I'm sure this is standard language, but it says the director of elections may adopt regulations. And do we use the word may because some of these sections do not require regulations, or should we actually say shall because it takes effect in April, and I'm just curious if that strengthens the bill to have the force of the word shall adopt regulations.
Tom?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, Tom Flynn again. So as I understand it, this section about transition regulations is actually a very standard sort of language for bills. And I think you're right that there would be some things that would need regulations and some things that might not, in which case that may might be more appropriate. But I'd be happy to give that more thought and get back to you.
And then a question for Ms. Fanumiai. Gail, with this short timeline, I mean, do you see that it's achievable for the division to promulgate regulations, and should we make them expedited or provide you somehow with some assistance, because I know the regulation process usually lasts months and you have feedback and comment period, and can you comment on that?
Gail Fidumiai for the Division of Elections, and Tom might also be able to chime in here. Through the chair, Senator Costello, if regulations that would need to be promulgated to as a result of passage of this legislation would have to be done, I believe, in the emergency regulation process, which means they would become effective immediately. And then there would be a time for public comment, and if they're not made permanent after a certain number of days, they would expire.
Just a follow-up. Does this language satisfy the ability to do the emergency regulations?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, I'm going to defer that one to Tom at the Department of Law.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Costello. So the authority for emergency regulations comes from the Administrative Procedure Act from somewhere else. And so I think that authority would remain and would be enough to do emergency regulations.
Mr. Chairman, one point. In the may versus shall, in terms of regulations, there are sections that require the division to do regulations. And so, and those are pretty clear. The division, division shall adopt regulations for X, Y, and Z. And so, and in terms of the may at the, you know, the catch-all, is any other regulations that might be required to achieve the goals of these other sections.
I see the intent. Right, yeah, where there's a separation that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Okay, Senator Costello, good.
I'm done.
And I'm going to ask real quick of Carrie and Alex here just to make sure that we're okay to go a few minutes past just to get – okay, I'm going to make sure we're not leaving them in the dust. So with that said, very briefly, do you have any finishing comments on sectional analysis?
The only thing, Mr. Chairman, is that the rest of the bill is the standard language in terms of effective dates, and, you know, crimes under this section only apply to those that are committed afterwards, and transition stuff.
Understood.
That's the sectional analysis.
In 1 minute or less, can you give us just a – for the record, the fiscal note, the analysis on that. You don't have to go to end of detail and read it all, but just kind of big picture, what are we looking at? So it's on the record and we've discussed it.
Yes, sir. The most the major expense in this bill is the signature verification requirement. We would have to have machines in all regional offices. And so fiscal note ranges right around, I believe, $5 billion. And that would be the one-time cost, you know, and out-year costs are not $5 million per year. And so high capital costs at the beginning, and then just some continuing costs in the out-years.
Copy. Senator Holland?
I just want to confirm that was million with an M.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, not billion.
Yes, sir.
We'd be in so much trouble. Okay. Other final comments? Go ahead, Senator Kawasaki.
And this actually goes to what Senator Costello was asking about, the 800 number, the toll-free 800 number, and whether there was a necessity to have staff to be able to answer those questions. Because I know right now they call their regional offices, and the regional office has like a call sheet like 200 deep just before elections come. And I just want to make sure that that is, if we are going to put this in a bill, there's some money somehow paid to ensure that that happens. Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's, and as we get into the more specifics of working with you and pulling out some of that language from your other bill, we'll certainly make sure that the fiscal note gets revised accordingly.
Okay, and I think we're going to finish on that one because we get much time. Actually, not too bad for a big bill to do that in less than an hour and a half. We will obviously come back. I'm going to put a date out, and I'm going to send that because I want to look at and talk to committee members. We'll send it via email on amendments for this as we step into the process, and we've already got you on the schedule. Come back here, I think, in about a week and a half, but I'll have to look at the exact date. I want to say February 10th, but I could be wrong on that. Maybe before that. So just be ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Josh, for coming in. Director Tom, thank you for your time tonight. And with that being said, you guys are cleared off the hot seats, and we're going to get on the second item and do our best to go quickly. Come on up. We've got Representative David Nelson with us, granting veteran benefits to Hmong veterans of the Vietnam War. And put yourself on the record, but I am going to speak just for a moment on this one because, and it's not going to take long for time, I want to be very clear that it's a very misunderstood group, in my opinion. And if you go read books on them, which I've read several, and as I've alluded to my wife's dad, who's in the back, she's in the back of the room, you know, for the service they had, and, well, speaking of Vietnam service, somebody just happens to walk in right at this time. Representative Laddie Shaw is with us. You know, half of his class died in Vietnam, half of his college class. I can't even imagine that today when we lose somebody, you know, just a couple of them. We're all nervous and upset about it. The point I drive with that is that the Hmong that served alongside U.S. servicemen, and in cases women, but mostly men at the time, in combat, many of them gave their lives and service to this nation, and they saved a whole lot of known and unknown U.S. servicemen with what they did. And so I want to be very clear when people wonder, who are they, what did they do? They had a natural hatred, really, for the communists and other stuff. There was a lot of tension there in the inner politics, but they served alongside our men and women. In Vietnam, and they served with distinction, and they were fierce warriors, and you should read something about them if you ever have a question on this. And so I wanted to kind of set the groundwork on this, David, going into it, because they are pretty amazing, some of the stories of what they did and why you're kind of bringing this forward. So that being said, you have the floor, put yourself on the record. Over to you.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for the Senate State Affairs for here in HGR 16. For the record, I am State Representative David Nelson, represent District 15, which is Muldoon and then the Elmendorf side of J-Bear. HAR 16 encourages the United States Congress to honor some of the promises made to Hmong veterans during the Vietnam War and grant them access to the same veteran benefits that United States soldiers receive today. In the 1960s, as Senator Schauer was alluding to, during the Vietnam War, over 100,000 Hmong soldiers served with distinction alongside the United States allies, United States soldiers, and they were recruited mainly by the United States Central Intelligence Agencies. They fought to intercept and prevent the flow of troops and supplies among the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and as many as 40,000 were killed as they supported and protected United States Armed Forces during combat missions. The Hmong warriors were heavily outnumbered. However, they continued to fight, gathering critical intelligence about enemy operations, and continued to take rescue missions to rescue downed United States airmen. The Hmong soldiers suffered acts of retribution and atrocities at the hand of the Pak Lao and North Vietnamese, causing many of them to flee to Thailand. These soldiers became refugees, and the United States government encouraged them to fight on their behalf. The Hmong people have fought bravely in what is called the Secret War, and for their loyalty were promised the same access to benefits as those received by United States veterans. The Hmong people have put their faith and trust into the United States government, and we are requesting that those promises are made true and asking the United States government to honor those. I'd be welcome to take any questions or comments that the committee may have.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you go into some detail on what sort of benefits we're talking about here as far as what benefits that we're asking them to be included in?
Okay. So right now, some of the benefits that they have just received even just recently include being buried at some of the national cemeteries, and that's a big one for them, but also being included into some of the veteran affair benefits, so hospital access and being allowed on bases for PX.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So I'll just continue with that. So, David, so, you know, when you look at this from a perspective of what we've done as a nation, we haven't always kept our promises. And, you know, when I think about this, I look at the past to guide us to the future. And if we didn't keep our promises to Hmong veterans, we didn't keep our promises to some of, and I'll go even to the day with Afghan. A lot of our Afghan allies that were there, we kind of left them in the dust. And that's not, I'm not pointing this finger at anybody politically. I'm saying that as a country, a nation, when we ask people to serve with us and serve alongside of us, we have to honor our promises. Because what happens in the future, now everybody else goes, man, you come here, you guys are just going to leave us. You're not going to do that. And so it puts our own people at risk because people don't want to work with us because they don't trust us. And this is about trust and fulfilling our promises as a nation, as a federal government, et cetera. So I think it's something we should be doing because this will probably come up for other nations, including Afghanistan and things we've seen, of promising things and fulfilling those promises across the board. This goes back a long time. And it's happened to our own service members. There's been times there's been promises made by the federal government. They didn't always keep those promises in ways as well. That's not the best way to do business. So I just throw that out from the perspective of what are the benefits and the why behind it. It's very important that we do that for future policy for our sons, daughters, grandkids that may have to fight alongside folks. That, and you want to be able to work with allies, and we want them to trust us. Well, to do that, we got to show that we can be trusted. And that's really, to me, that's the core of the issue. I know it wasn't planned, but we have Representative Shaw, who, by the way, you didn't talk about the Navy. You only talked about soldiers. I'm just saying. You might talk about those squids in there, too. If you would like, if Laddie, if you would like to come up, you're welcome. You don't have to, but if you're welcome to come say anything, I would we'd be honored to have your testimony about what you saw or any reason why this is important.
Thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chairman. Laddie Shaw, I represent District 26, Lower Hillside. I served with the Navy SEALs in the Delta, what the Army called it, Four Corps, and my lifeline was the Hmong community. When we went out to gather intel, we seldom went out without a Hmong soldier with us. They would even convince a Viet Cong to turn over and be a Kit Carson scout for us to benefit our intel gathering. And as was noted, the amount of Hmong soldiers that gave their lives, and actually in the retribution as we were leaving in 1975, the retribution probably took just as many family lives by the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese as soldiers that were lost. When I was the director for the Division of Veterans Affairs back in my state employment days, we spent about 2 years to get benefits for the Alaska Territorial Guard. We talk about soldiers forgotten. These were men who left their families at 14 or 15 years old to serve their country and to sacrifice basically for their homeland, the coast of Alaska. And we ended up getting full military and veterans benefits for the Alaska Territorial Guard. We were able to bring together their time as a Territorial Guardsman and some active duty time that they had put with the National Guard. And one of our individuals, Sam Herman, was 74 years old when he finally got a retired military ID card. The emotions to this day were absolutely overwhelming. So if we can do it for one group of people that sacrificed, and they literally, under Muktuk Marston, they literally were given portions of uniforms, old guns, as many bullets as they could gather, well-deserving. And my comments here, and I appreciate so much you allowing me to take just a few minutes to make these comments, the Hmong soldiers are definitely as deserving, if not more. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Shaw. Much appreciated. Okay, so I have a question here, and I'm going to just leave this on the record. I'm not going to go off the record. We had not planned on public testimony because it's kind of just a thought process getting back into the swing of it. We were just going to bring it up next week on Tuesday, ask for the standard protocol for amendments and public testimony. Got a note earlier, but I'm going to defer to the folks that have been here longer because I haven't actually tried to do this, and I want to make sure it's right, though, for the record. Can we waive that public testimony and move this? Because I'm comfortable moving it. I don't think we need public testimony, and I don't think we're going to see anybody standing against this. That being said, we have to do it right. So I'm asking for those while we're on the record, is this something that we can waive and move according to uniform rules, or do we have to hold this and notice it for next Tuesday and then get it out of committee? And I'm going to ask, and we can just have the discussion here with everybody listening, because I honestly don't know. I haven't tried. Senator, anybody?
Senator Schauer, we could take a brief at ease after this, but I believe you could just open public testimony, see if there's anyone here or online, and close it. But I think we could take a brief at ease and ask those who really know.
We'll do that. I just want to make sure while we're here, because I don't want this to be hidden, or why did they close the mic? Because if we're comfortable with that and it's following the rules, that's okay. So we're going to do that for a moment. We'll be right back. Going to take an at ease. Back in the record. Sorry, folks. We wanted to make sure we were going to get this right, and we were following the procedures to move the bill. So, Representative Nelson, if you want to give us your closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the committee for hearing this bill and possibly moving it out today. I do want to draw your attention to the support and oppose at the end of your bill packet. The Hmong community, Hmong Alaska Community Inc., they have written many letters of support. And they are very enthusiastic about this resolution. And speaking with some of the remaining Hmong veterans that served during the Vietnam War, this is something that they take very close to their heart and is extremely meaningful to them. And so you would be able to see through some of them that, for instance, like Pastor Rhett Lee, who is the president of the Hmong Alaska Community Inc., some of their own personal stories that they had to go through. So I do appreciate it, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
So just to be clear on that, you said it's support and oppose. I see no opposition.
Yes.
It's all support.
Correct. All support.
Because you kind of dope me there. And then just for the note as well, or for the record, there is a zero fiscal note associated
correct.
With this, so that everything is there. With that being said, we had a discussion on moving the bill today. It was not in the plan, but everybody agrees that's the best course of action. So I'm going to ask Senator Costello, do we have a motion for the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Joint Resolution Number 16, Version 32-LS0795/Bravo from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying zero fiscal note.
Thank you, Senator Costello. Very well done. Are there any objections? Seeing no objections, House Joint Resolution Number 16 is moved out of State Affairs Committee. Thank you very much, Representative Nelson. You are cleared off. And Representative Shaw, thanks for showing up and talking today. All right, that being said, concludes our business for today. Senate State Affairs Committee will be meeting this next Tuesday, February 1st, 2022, 3:30, back in this room. We take in public disregard that one. Had to catch the script up. We'll be looking at SB 136, an act relating to firearms and other weapons restrictions. We'll be looking at SB 147, an act requiring the Department of Administration to allow individuals to execute an anatomical gift when renewing a driver's license and establishing April of each year's Donate Life Month. SB 145, an act relating to per diem for legislators and providing for an effective date, and seeing no other business for the committee. And with a thank you to the staff for staying a little bit late today to get that done, we'll reflect the time as 5:11. We are adjourned.